I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1972. The album is FM and AM, and the artist is George Carlin. My guest is Clive Desmond. So what made you pick George Carlin? Let's start with the fact that I heard your piece that ended up on 99% Invisible about this very about radio advertising that specifically covered a lot of Stan Freberg's work. And so I expected you to pick Stan Freberg out of, and I love that out of left field, I got another Carlin album, one we've never talked about before.
I first saw George Carlin, I suspect, on the Smothers Brothers.
Okay, sure.
And that's wrong. Now, let me go back farther, turn the way back machine. I first saw him on Ed Sullivan when he had Brill creamed hair, and he wore a skinny suit, a Don Draper-esque suit. And he came out and he did a pretty clever, a really clever act based on language and on words. And that caught my attention as a kid, as a 10-year-old, as a 9-year-old. And then when he went through his hippie phase, by certainly 1970, I was, 13?
Mm-hmm.
And he had grown his hair long and was wearing jeans. And was making, you know, saying nasty, dirty words and making reference to way more controversial issues than he had when he first showed up on Sullivan. And excuse me, I don't have one of those cough buttons here. And he just, his understanding of language happened at a time that it concurred with my more sophisticated understanding of language and double meaning and irony. And, you know, you probably are aware of, I think his name is Leventhal. He wrote, This Is Your Music on Brain. This Is Your Brain on Music.
Boy, I don't know. I'm not familiar with. You're going to have to educate me.
He's a former session musician and recording engineer, originally from Montreal. And then he went down to UCLA and he got his PhD in neurology, and he wrote a really important book on how music affects your brain. And one of the things he points out in the book is that by the time we're about 12 or 13, we enter a cognitive state that lets us understand something as sophisticated as irony and double meanings.
Interesting.
And so I was right at that point. I think it's Levinson. I'll send it to you after the interview because you want to try and read the book. I got about a quarter of the way through because it's a little over my head. But Carlin came along just as I was of an age where I was beginning to understand that there could be double meanings happening here, and he explored language beautifully, as I would imagine you would agree with me. That you could do a stand-up routine on how we form sentences and how we speak in these codes that our parents don't know what we're talking about when we talk to each other. It was really exciting for me. And as I said in that episode of 99% Invisible, once I discovered irony, I was looking around for it everywhere for the next, you know, 7-8 years.
See, that's perfect. I absolutely agree with you, just to get that out of the way. But I had my suspicions, but I love that somebody's done the study. Now I absolutely do want to read the book, because everybody who comes on the show, and maybe I'm generalizing too much, but that is absolutely the age where people have picked their comedy or found something that really sticks with them for the rest of their lives. Whether they still like it or not, it doesn't even matter. There are times when people find something that sticks with them at the time and has stuck with them since, but they haven't listened to it since, and they'll go back and it wasn't that great, but it doesn't matter. You are suddenly aware and being able to grasp not just new concepts, but new way to think about concepts. And I mean, for me, it's absolutely true. That's the exact time I started figuring out how to do comedy as a kid, because I was listening to, for better or worse, Cheech and Chong and George Carlin, for sure. The Smothers Brothers also, because my mother passed down all these records at just the right time. I love so much that got to be your experience, but in the moment, because that is something I will never have experienced, having Carlin there in the moment and evolving in front of me.
The book is called This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of Human Obsession.
Okay.
And it came out in 2007, and it's by Daniel J. Levitin, L-E-V-I-T-I-N. And it goes a long way in explaining, although the book is about music,
mm-hmm.
It goes a long way in explaining why as a kid, as a 13-year-old, did I find Rusty Warren, who's from a completely different generation than mine
sure.
or yours. Why is this funny? It's because it's ironic.
Uh-huh.
You know, she thought she was being so, and she was to her audience, that she was being avant-garde and, you know, pushing the envelope. But once a kid discovers that there are hidden meanings in things,
mm-hmm.
it's that cat's out of the bag or that horse is out of the barn and the door can never be closed. At least it wasn't ever closed in my case.
Right. And I know myself, when I discovered that, I ended up looking for it in too many places, and comedy ended up, at least for me at the time, serving my love of irony, I think, too much. So sitcoms as I grew up were too snarky, too self-aware, too filled with irony, to the point where I think there's been a rejection of that in a lot of pop culture now, but I do love being there at a time. When did you first hear Rusty Warren? Because I can't remember when I first heard her, but I definitely didn't get it at the time, not in the same way it sounds like you're describing it.
Well, I'm 60 now, so in the summer of, it had to be between 71 and 72, so I was 12, 13, and I was at a friend's cottage in the Muskokas, which is a cottagey type of area north of Toronto, and the mom... she liked to tipple back a few. I think the dad had passed away, but mom sure liked to drink. My friend's mom.
Uh-huh.
And Canadian whiskey, Canadian Club whiskey, 7 and 7 was her drink. And she would, she was an old style society gal. She loved Rusty Warren. And she'd haul this thing out and I'd hear it in the distance, and I didn't really understand it because there was a boathouse and there was a cottage, and the teenage boys all stayed in the boathouse, and uh-huh. she was up there with her friends playing bridge. And I'd hear it from time to time. And one day when she was out or whatever, wherever she went, I grabbed the record and I put it on, and I brought it down to the boathouse because we had our own dual turntable down there with speakers. We used to take it up to the cottage
uh-huh.
to listen to records on the weekend. And I put on the Rusty Warren record, and I couldn't believe it. Knocker's Up, and you know, then there was she broke my back when she started singing People, because she was a musician originally. She was
yeah.
a cocktail singer, and she was doing her thing, Knocker's Up, ladies, and she was leading these women around the stage. You could hear them on the stage, and they had martini glasses. Do they call them flutes? On their boobs, marching around in front of their drunken husbands. And then she started singing People. And then she gave a soliloquy on children, that we have to do what we can to look after our kids. And I just thought this was a window into a kind of comedy I'd never heard.
Mm-hmm.
And then I listened to it, I think, the rest of the summer. And I wouldn't say it was an obsession, because
right.
it wasn't. Well, maybe it was. You'll be the judge, Jason. You'll have to judge this. But I listened to it over and over again. And then when I discovered intoxicating smokable substances,
uh-huh.
and I combined those, these neuralizing plants with Rusty Warren, I thought, you know, I had just fallen down a rabbit hole and I was never coming out.
Uh-huh.
And she came and she played Toronto. And we tried to get in to see her. Then I convinced my friends. I was a persuasive fellow. And I convinced my kind of neo-hippie friends, because we weren't real hippies. We were too young to be hippies.
Uh-huh.
We just had the long hair. And I tried to convince my friends to go to the airport, some airport lounge, to see her perform.
Oh, my God.
And only one came with me, Andrew Kilgore. He was the oldest of our troupe. And he thought it was really funny shit, too. So can I swear on this?
Or? Oh, absolutely.
He thought she was really funny shit too. So we went to some airport lounge, and it was packed. And they let me in, and they shouldn't have, because it was a licensed place and it was an adults only show.
Sure.
But I will admit something that I have never admitted to a total stranger before. But when I was 14, I was so information hungry to see adult, forbidden adult things, like the French, detective, like The Exorcist, anything that was, you know, for adults only. So I went to the local theatrical store downtown called Malabar, and I purchased a fake mustache that matched my hair color and a little bottle of spirit glue is what they called it. And I would put this fucking mustache on and I could go into any place I wanted. And I was, when I was 14, I looked 8.
Oh my God.
You know, but I put this mustache on and nobody had the nerve or the gall, or maybe it was Canadian. It would be considered impolite. So they wouldn't dare ask me, can we see some ID here, kid?
Oh.
You know?
That's amazing.
They didn't ask that at all.
That's amazing.
And so I went and saw Rusty. I saw Rusty do her thing on the big screen. And not on the big screen, but on the big stage.
Sure.
And I was simply delighted. Would I go back? No. One time was enough to see her. Have you seen her perform?
I've never seen her perform. I've met her. She's a friend of mine, but I've never gotten to see her perform, which makes me sad. I wish I could have seen it at least once.
How did you meet Rusty Warren?
When I was in college at Columbia College Chicago, I took a romantic comedy writing class, and the main character was supposed to be about a funny woman in the 30s. It just happened to be. And my teacher said, well, you should look up Rusty Warren. She was a bawdy comedian of the 60s. Check her out. And I looked her up. She had an email. She was hip to email in her 70s. She lived in Hawaii at the time. And I checked in with her every couple of years. And then when I started this podcast, I checked in with her realizing, oh, I should try. She's probably still in Hawaii. Well, I lucked out. She's actually out here now for her health. And I believe she still is. And she sat down with me for about 2 hours and made a two-part episode out of it. She was just brilliantly smart and wonderful and sweet, and it was so much fun. And like, she really appreciated that I got that there was some feminism in her goofy, silly mom humor.
Was Rusty aware of the implications of what she was doing, or I'm assuming she had some idea that she was breaking some taboos, certainly for how women saw, how a female comic would see themselves and portray themselves.
She knew that much. For sure she knew she was breaking the taboos, and I don't know that she appreciates, or that many people appreciate, that hitting that demographic of housewives who are not allowed to think or speak in certain ways, breaking into that demographic is actually hugely important. Whether you can ever measure that in numbers, I don't know, but I don't know that she appreciates that on that level. Most people don't. But she at the very least understood that she was doing something that she thought was important, which was just give these other women some entertainment. She's like, I'm sure she thought, there's no shit out there for me. What am I going to watch or listen to? There's nothing saying the stuff I'm thinking. So I think it came from a natural place.
Well, she's a proto, at the risk of sounding like public radio, she's a proto Phyllis Diller.
Sure.
And she's a proto Joan Rivers.
Absolutely, yeah.
And without her, without Rusty opening that door, and it was way more than a crack, because when she came here in the 70s, that show was totally sold out at the Airport Lounge, and there had to be there had to be 300 or 400 people in that room.
I love it.
It was like kind of a Vegas show. And I knew who Joan Rivers was.
Sure.
And I knew who Phyllis Diller. Did you know Phyllis Diller, by the way, is a very good classical pianist?
That I did not know. That is a new piece of information.
She, when she wasn't playing the role of Phyllis Diller and touring and doing television, I think she's from Cincinnati, or she lived in Philadelphia or something, but she played under her real name, which is not Phyllis Diller, and I can't remember what it was, or maybe she had a stage name. But she played classical music with the Cincinnati or the Philadelphia Philharmonic. She
was
very
good.
You can see her on YouTube.
That's
so she was
amazing. A
classical thing. But Rusty was, I think Rusty, we need to go back and look at Rusty, and we need somebody from some journalist or writer type to go back and look at Rusty and review what she was doing and when. Because there's a very interesting article or biography to be written about her, and there's probably a very interesting movie in the hands of a skilled writer and director and actor.
Believe
me, Rusty Warren's story.
As a documentarian, that thought has never left my mind. I gotta say, yeah, I 100% agree. I will say that if people go on Amazon, you can look up. There is a book that Rusty just released. Her publicist and archivist just released. That is like, it's a book that is basically a series of articles that were written about her over the years, which is kind of fun. Uh-huh. But an absolutely like a, for sure, an actual biographical book of her would be phenomenal. Now would be the time. That's a very good question. That's a good question. We never delved too deep into it because I couldn't tell how comfortable she was talking about that part of her personal life, interestingly enough. She would talk about the ideas of sex, the ideas of this, the ideas of that, the ideas of being married, but the details of her actual personal life I never delved into just in case. And just because, well, you know.
We're gonna go into that topic right now.
All right.
What we're going to find is that Warren produced a DVD that chronicles her life in show business. The DVD Rusty Warren Knockers Up, The Lady Behind the Laughs was released by GNP Crescendo in 2008. And that's all it says about her. That's not much of a personal life. That's all it says about her personal life.
I know.
And a childhood growing up in Milton, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
So... and I'm one of the few people who's been to Milton, Massachusetts.
Interesting.
And while I was there, I had no idea that, she grew up there and that her musical mentor was, are you sitting down, Jason?
Mm-hmm.
Arthur Fiedler.
That I don't think I knew at all. That's insane.
Who went on to conduct the Boston Pops.
That's insane.
I know. So she, she was born in New York City she was born in New York City in 1930 and adopted 6 months later by a couple called Helen and Herbert Goldman.
That's right.
A couple from Milton, Massachusetts. And who named her, what does this say? Eileen Goldman. So, yeah, so I saw her at this thing, at this lounge, and I thought this, you know, she was charismatic and funny, and I was not of that age.
Mm-hmm.
In the least. I didn't know anything, you know, it was pre-Dick Van Dyke. So I thought she was, I just thought it was an interesting window to see, God bless her, as I believe she's passed on. But for me, it was a window into a time machine, into a past that I had not lived through. And just as I was discovering, irony through George Carlin, and mm-hmm. then through Flip Wilson, which we have to talk about,
mm-hmm.
And the Smothers Brothers. I mean, those people were all made for my generation.
For sure. I will say very quickly, Rusty is still around, and if you want her phone number, I'm sure she'd be happy to talk to you.
Oh, I don't want to bother Rusty other than, you know, what I would love is an email address because I would love to send her a letter.
Of course. Yeah. I'm sure she would. Just remind me. I will absolutely send that to you. I love that I Flip Wilson's coming up, too. Oh, my God. There's so much to dig into. Let's talk very quickly about the Carlin album, just so that we can say we talked about the Carlin album.
Okay, AM, FM. Yes. I listened to a bunch of clips of it this morning,
mm-hmm.
and I listened to WINO, Wino Radio.
Of course.
And what is the opening cut on that album? It's not Wino, it's, oh, shit. It's where he says shit.
Uh-huh, yeah. Talking about the differences between shit and shoot and all those different...
Yeah. And how adults use that word, don't like to use that word.
Mm-hmm.
And it's used, but you'll hear it from time to time. You know, you'll hear your best friend's mother say, oh shit, I burnt the roast. Uh-huh. I didn't say that, she would say. I thought that George Carlin was just so spot on. I don't know if he knew that he was speaking to 12 and 13 year old boys. I would assume he did because he was no dummy.
Mm-hmm.
And that his basic study of language that he unpacks so beautifully all the way through that album, because I listened to most of it throughout the day today.
Mm-hmm.
It's a course all to itself. When he did the Wino Radio, what do you call it? Shtick, piece, chapter, cut?
Whatever you want to call it.
The Wino Radio thing, it alerted me that I wanted to be. I'd grown up, as you can tell from that, the 700-foot mountain of whipped cream. I was obsessed by commercials and I was obsessed by the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, when I was around 12 years old, I thought, when my voice began to break, I thought, well, you know, maybe I could be one of these announcer types. Because I had, which you don't find out in this episode, but I had a couple of friends whose dads were in the ad business.
Oh, okay.
Were creative directors. There was a jingle producer who lived down the street. I lived in a weird neighborhood, but there were two creative directors whose dads I was, kids I was friends with. There was a jingle producer whose kid I was friendly with. The parents and the way they lived opened this whole world to me. And as I said in the episode, and I said in that story, I would go to my friend's office and on the weekends when his dad had custody of him, and that was Taylor, and we would listen to radio commercials and watch TV commercials on 16 millimeter film while the dad did whatever the dad was doing.
Right.
And so I got exposed to all of this, and then my voice broke, and it broke early. And I thought, maybe I could do these commercial things. Maybe. I'd really like to. It'd be great. And then George Carlin grew his hair long, and he came out, and he did a TV version of Wino Radio on the Smothers Brothers or on one of these shows, Flip Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's it. Because he taught me voice modulation, how to sound like a DJ.
Yeah.
And how DJs sound. And then he did all those sound effects with his voice.
Yes.
And then he did tape. He replicated tape echo, tape echo, tape echo, tape echo. Wino, wino, wino. Weather, weather, sports, 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 sports. And I said, God, I could do that too. And I've got, you know, this kind of voice. And that was George Carlin taught me modulation. He taught me how to sound like a real guy. You know, when you hear Alec Baldwin on his radio show, and he does a lot of voice acting when he's interviewing people, especially if they're New Yorkers, because mm-hmm. he can reference characters that they would know from Long Island and
sure.
Connecticut and New Jersey. George Carlin did this all the time, and he would play characters from his childhood, adult characters that he paid attention to when he was a kid, and he would go in and out of these voices, but he wasn't really acting as much as just doing impressions of them.
Sure, yeah.
And then I learned how to do that, and so... And I've had a really pretty good run as a voice actor, providing it was an intention, but I didn't think it would actually come true. But I've done a lot of that kind of work, and never as a character, just talking like I'm talking to you now, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Carlin who showed me that you could do this with your voice.
I'm jealous that you had that realization, I gotta say, because I the more I'm thinking of it now, I'm like, oh, I think I might have learned these same exact lessons from him just from memorizing bits and repeating them back into microphones as a kid. I'm now realizing I think I probably learned a lot of that same stuff that you're talking about from Carlin.
No, absolutely, because he would do a guy from Long Island, Long Island from Five Towns who talk like this.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Lenny. You know, just that little kind of Irish Catholic guy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he would do all of these things.
Congolia Breckenridge.
Sorry, that's my favorite one.
And he could do these things, but they were it was done in a very limited range. You know, Rich Little
mm-hmm.
could do, and the now booted out of show business, Kevin Spacey.
Yep.
They can do full-blown, full-range impersonations. But... I didn't get, what's his face? George Carlin didn't do that. He would just do snippets of people that he knew growing up in the Lower East Side, or, you know, traveling around the New York area, priests, cops, the guy at the liquor store when he was old enough to go in and buy a bottle of liquor. He picked up on how those people spoke. And that, to me, is a completely different bag of talent.
Mm-hmm.
That, as I said, you'll hear Alec Baldwin do it from time to time because he's an actor and he's really good at it. But it's not the impersonation of Kevin Spacey or Rich Little or people of that ilk. But it is in itself very requires a really good ear, and it requires a lot of practice to do it as beautifully and as effortlessly as George Carlin did. Although he would say maybe it wasn't,
right?
Maybe it was effortless, but I don't know.
It's hard to say. Yeah, and that's one of those things where I feel like not enough people ever interviewed him about. Acting in general.
Him.
You know, they interviewed him plenty about stand-up and never about acting, so it would have been nice to know what his perspective on it was. It probably would have been a silly perspective. It probably would have been a jokey perspective, but I would have liked to know.
Well, in the end, Carlin, in my observation, in the end, Carlin became more of a social critic, of like a psychiatrist for the society,
mm-hmm.
or a psychotherapist of the society.
Sure.
He spent less time in comedy in where he had started, and in the latter part of his career. I wish somebody had asked him, where did you hear these voices? Did you practice them?
Mm-hmm.
Where exactly did you grow up? Who was that voice based on, and who was his character? What are the voices you've never shown us that you do? I mean, there was a lot of stuff about him that we don't know, because certainly in the latter part of his career, so many of the questions were politically based,
for sure,
sociologically based, and good for him that he stuck to his guns and he answered them with a clarity that few comedians can do.
I really liked listening to this album. This is weird. So the one album I feel like we've done the most, well, the albums we've done the most is probably a tie between Let's Get Small and Class Clown. And Class Clown is one of my favorites of all time. Released the same year as FMAM. It's brilliant. But what I realized today listening to this is, like, I've heard one bit off of it. I had never heard the full album until today. And I'm a huge Carlin fan, but because of this podcast, unless somebody tells me to listen to it, I usually don't have the time. And I'm very glad that you picked this one, because this is a perfect, because everybody points out that Takeoffs and Put-Ons, which is right before this one, 5 years before this one, is still kind of like, quote-unquote, Square George moving on into this new guy. And here he's talking about, you know, I got fired for saying shit, and I cut my hair, or I grew my hair out, you know, and blah, 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 blah. And I did not realize there was an album that just quite clearly delineated this change in who he was, and I really liked listening to it for that reason, if no other.
Well, he is proto Howard Stern.
For sure.
He, and I don't know how old Howard Stern is. I think he's a little older than me or a little younger than me, but Howard Stern had to be sitting out there in Long Island and Five Towns, where he grew, I think he's from Five Towns, listening to Seven Words You Can Never Say on Television. And everything that was Saturday Night Live, who's the producer of that? He's from Toronto. He used to deliver his newspaper. Lorne Michaels.
Mm-hmm.
All of that album, FM and AM and Class Clown, that set, in my theory, in my observation, set the tone for where comedy was going to go, where it had never gone before, certainly in television and in radio, between George Carlin and the Firesign Theater. And I think he may have lit the flame for the Firesign Theater, too. I think they may have been smoldering, where they had a wick, but it was Carlin who, you know, lit a match to that wick. With Seven Words You Cannot Say, You Can Never Say on Television. He was a brilliant, brilliant guy. I saw him as a kid two or three times.
Oh, I'm jealous.
And at a beautiful theater in town here, which is still here. It's now the Sony Center, but in those days it was called the O'Keefe Center. And I was stunned. Jason, I was 13 or 14, and I went to this, and I went alone, because I can't remember. Getting tickets was hard. I don't remember how it was. I think I was alone. And I went to this huge 2,000 seat theater called the O'Keefe Center. And this little man walks out alone. And for the next 2 hours, you just couldn't I couldn't believe. I was so envious. How can you keep people's attention for that long? How do you do this? How do you memorize this? How is it you're so funny? How is it you're so relevant? How is it you're who you are? How do you do this? And how you use the microphone and distort it to get these effects. And
yeah.
The room was, he had that room in his hand. And I went back and saw him, I think two or three more times. And he was really great, as was Flip Wilson, which is where I think I may have seen him on his first appearance after he grew his hair long and started smoking weed and started speaking out against the Vietnam War. And, you know, he had drifted right into the counterculture. But he couldn't have been really that far into the counterculture because he made so much sense. He wasn't inarticulate.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't high on drugs doing that show. There's no possible way you could do that.
Right.
Maybe later when he got into cocaine. But certainly when I saw him in the 70s, he was absolutely the top of his game. He was It was stunning. I think he had a lot to do with where a lot of comedy ended up within the next 2 years, which is when Saturday Night Live began. And Howard Stern was fermenting out there somewhere in Radio Land as a kid, listening to all of this stuff.
I hadn't thought about it in, I don't think about Howard Stern ever, but I hadn't thought about it in that way that, yeah, that is absolutely perfect timing for folks like him who would again, for lack of a better term, push the envelope, 20 years later and just switch the way people think about the words people speak and what you're allowed to say and what you aren't. I mean, it's funny too, because Class Clown I first heard when I was 16. So that would have been 96 when I first heard that album. And I mean, but that was still, I knew it was out there, and I, even though shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits were not that shocking, the idea that he put them together in that certain way and had this beautiful, lilting way of describing what these things mean, I cannot imagine seeing that live. And I'm so incredibly jealous of you. Did you only see him during the 70s?
Yeah, I only saw him during the 70s. And I didn't realize until you spoke about shit, piss, cunt, tits, motherfucker. What are all the words? The seven words you can't say.
Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits.
That is a seminal argument about free speech.
Absolutely.
That's what it's all about. He never uses the phrase. He never says free speech, which, as we know, at the University of Berkeley, where it started, has just been tossed out the door by these social justice warriors and by the progressives. But he was talking about free speech. And I know that he was, that was burned indelibly into his young mind by hearing Lenny Bruce.
Sure.
And it's a very odd topic. It's a very odd topic for a comedian to pick. Let's do something on free speech.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why don't we do the right to life?
Right.
Why don't we do same-sex marriage? I mean, we can say these things now, but in 1970, in 1972, these ideas were just, there was no way you could go on the Dinah Shore show and talk about any of this stuff. You couldn't use the phrase free speech. And you wouldn't think of using it because maybe it wasn't just such a, maybe the pendulum moves back and forth and we don't know exactly where it's always moving when you're in the time. But when I think back to it now, that's what he was addressing. Flip Wilson. Wow. Flip Wilson was another guy as a boy, I listened to, of course, I listened to Bill Cosby.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this Bill Cosby, because he had that, I didn't know he was a comedian. I first saw him, this is long before you were probably born. He did a series with Robert Culp where they played spies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first interracial kind of TV starring pairing.
Right.
They were pre Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they happened at the same time. But so I listened to, and I knew, and I liked him as a kid. He was very funny. Of course, he's not very funny now. But Flip Wilson comes out of the Bill Cosby thing on the surface. But I think if we look a little deeper at who Flip Wilson was and what he was all about, he isn't really part of that Cosby's world. He's part of something else. I don't know what world he's part of, but when he came out dressed as a woman and did the Geraldine thing, I'd never seen a drag act before. It was the first time I'd ever seen a man dressed as a woman.
Uh-huh.
When was the first time you saw a drag? And it was the only, him and Divine are the only drag acts I ever thought were funny.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of them don't do anything for me. Nobody can compare to Divine.
Sure.
And nobody could compare to Geraldine.
She's such a strong characterization. Like, it was the first time we ever talked about Flip Wilson on the show was with Timothy Amundsen from Psych, and he spent, I feel like, half the episode just doing his Geraldine impression, and it was amazing. Like, it sticks with you.
I was of an age that Flip Wilson, the Smothers Brothers, and Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In all came on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
they were all running in the same era. And Flip Wilson, of course, was and so was George Carlin, always appearing in little snippets on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, was... I would watch Artie Shaw do Very Interesting and Ruth Buzzy and those characters. And after the show, and after Flip Wilson, I would go upstairs, and there was... My washroom was around a corner from my bedroom. And I would lock myself in the washroom, and I would stare in a mirror, and I would do Flip Wilson impersonation. Then I would do Geraldine. Then I would do Dick Rowan. Then I would do, what was Martin's name? Dick and, I can't remember.
I
would
remember.
Do those guys and do the lines that I'd seen in the program. And I would, and then when the cassette recorder came out, I started taping these shows. And I would go to my room and I would listen to George Carlin do Wino Radio and see how he modulated his voice and what his tricks were. And then I would do Flip Wilson, and then I would try and do Geraldine, and then I would do Artie Shaw, and then I would try and do Rowan and Martin. And I was taping all of this stuff and listening to it very carefully, and with the hope that I'll become a radio voiceover announcer, and maybe they'll even use me on TV. That did kind of happen, but it didn't happen in the way that I wanted. It happened completely by happenstance.
That's
at a much later point in my life.
Did having that in your quiver in any way help you, or did it just help you in that you felt prepared?
I felt prepared.
Yeah.
And because I had directed so many actors before, and I had directed so many commercials and so many comedians and so many actors and so many famous ones, that I was so used to being in a room near a mic with these guys. And after you do a couple, after you make a couple hundred commercials, certain patterns begin to emerge.
Mm-hmm.
You observe certain things out of these performers. And these voice performers who are normally associated with on camera or television, if they're famous.
Mm-hmm.
And then even the ones who aren't on camera but are just voice actors, you begin to pick up things that they're doing that you like, and you emulate them. And so I was prepared. So when somebody called me to do a dog food ad and then a car ad, and then when I figured out how it was I sounded, because I had to ask, what do you think I sound like when I speak? And... invariably, you sound very well educated, and you sound like you have money, and you sound like you've got money, and you're educated. I said, okay. And so, why would you want me to do your dog food commercial?
Right.
Do money people have dogs? Is that a thing? You get rich, and you get a dog, and then you have to feed it, so you buy Pedigree pet food or Alpo. I don't know. But I was fully ready, because also I'd been behind a microphone so many times doing demos for people and doing animatics. Do you know anything about the commercial business?
Just a little.
Okay, so before you make a TV commercial, you make an animatic. And an animatic is drawings of how the commercial is going to unfold.
Sure.
And so for cheap, you go into a studio. They would hire me to go into a studio, and then I would read, open on... A beautiful home in suburbia. The front door opens and a little dog runs out. He runs off screen. Then a child runs out of the door and runs in the direction of where the dog went. Then the mom comes out and says, Bobby, Bobby. Then an announcer cuts in and says, do you treat your dog like a puppy? You shouldn't. You should feed him Alpo food. So I did enough of these kind of things that when, sometimes they would just say, oh, well, why don't you just do the final?
Uh-huh.
Okay, sure.
That's fascinating. You know, so. I never, that is one thing that's never occurred to me, is to simply just ask someone, what do I sound like to you? And as long as they don't say Paul Giamatti again, I'm fine. Well, it's usually that's what I look like. But I never thought to ask somebody. That's a very simple question that I feel like could guide you pretty well.
Well, what character is it? I mean, I get it all the time from people. A couple times a month, if I'm going, when the weather is a little more forgiving here, it's been terrible in the Northeast, as I'm sure you know.
Mm-hmm.
A couple times a month, strangers, well, twice a month, a couple times, if on a good month, somebody will say to me, Has anyone ever told you you have a beautiful voice? Somebody will say to me in a session, you sound exactly like, and then I'll say, Kevin Spacey? Yeah, you sound just like him. And my whole life people have said, oh, you have such a beautiful voice. Are you on the radio, or are you an actor, or do you do commercials? Or, and I don't think I have that interesting a voice. It's just, it's mid-rangey. It has some bottom and I can fry. Mm-hmm. If I EQ it right and I do things to my voice, but most of the time it just doesn't strike me as being. I sound like I'm in the bedroom, and I'm told, and I'm often hired to, because they say, "Oh, you have a bedroom voice." And doing the podcast, Pod Planet, which is, it took me a year to learn how to do that voice, where it sounds like I'm not acting, even though I'm acting, I'm unacting. So.
That's fascinating. Are there any particular, other than Carlin, are there any other comedians in particular who might have informed your speaking, your work as a voice actor, I mean?
Are there any other? Let's just take a look here. Because I made a list. This is, actually, this is the most fun. Comedy on Vinyl. This is the most fun because I can sit here in front of my computer and talk to you. And I can look up things that we had discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Did Bill Cosby inform me anything vocally? No, he was a big character voice.
Sure,
he could do cartoons for sure. Lenny Bruce, I honestly haven't heard enough of him. I've heard plenty of him.
Sure,
but I never really sat down and listened carefully to it. Woody Allen, absolutely. During the late 70s and early 80s, I was mad for Woody Allen, and I lived in New York and I saw him all over the place in New York. I sat across from him at dinner one night when he was with his sister, and I'd see him in bookstores and stuff. But because I'm not Jewish and I'm not from Brooklyn or Far Rockaway, I could do an impersonation of it, but I'm never asked. Nobody ever wants you to sound like Woody Allen in a commercial.
Right.
They do want you to sound like the Hippy Dippy Weatherman, and George Carlin was a good, you know, he had all that stuff down. And he had a beautiful, beautiful speaking voice. And so Carlin probably informed me the most. And you're not hearing it now, but if I put on George Carlin, I can, and I think about it and get into the mood very quickly, I could inhabit the vocal space that he uses.
Mm-hmm.
And I would do a mediocre job of it, but you could tell, oh, this guy listened to Carlin.
you know,
because the real thing, you can't beat the real thing.
What's funny is, like, I have I don't know what range my voice is or anything, but Carlin's one of those guys who I feel like I can do at least confidently on a microphone. But the people who have come on my show who can do a good Carlin have shocked me. Right. It's very.
You are speaking.
Sorry.
Your resonating note is either a G or an A above D.
Okay.
And that's the resting note you return to. Okay. Your voice is up there. That's when you speak a fourth or a fifth above me. I speak on a D note or a C in the mornings.
Mm-hmm.
And I would guess to say you speak at 88 beats per minute. And because you're a quick talker. And you sound like a regular, trustworthy guy, and you'd probably like baseball. You'd be believable as a guy who liked baseball.
I'll take it. I feel, but like,
not, but not golf.
Well, that's absolutely. Well, I mean, the not liking golf part is absolutely true. All right. Well, see, these are all things to keep in mind, you know, for the future.
And you also sound like a man who cannot, for the life of him, speak to children. He cannot code switch. When he talks to kids, you know how some people code switch when they talk to kids.
Sure.
You don't sound like you can do that. You sound like you're always you, and you sound like you're talking to them as an adult, and that you can't understand why they're not getting your point.
Yeah, that's way too accurate.
And I don't know if that's true.
This has become a psychic reading all of a sudden. I can switch gears, but I do have a tendency to talk to them like they are adults first, and then realize, oh, that doesn't work. that's perfect. The two people on my show who have done Carlin in front of me are John DiMaggio and Todd Glass, the stand-up, and two guys who I guess I wouldn't peg to be doing Carlin impressions, but they both do very good ones.
Well, he was it. I mean, Carlin had vocal chops because he was originally a radio guy. He came out of being, as I understand it.
Uh-huh.
He had worked at some radio stations in the Northeast as young as 19 or 20.
It's crazy.
And he was on air, and I don't know how successful he was, and I know he didn't really like it much. Because he just eviscerates in that piece he does on Wino.
Mm-hmm.
How stupid these people sound. So, but he had, you know, he has great chops. And listening to them this afternoon or this morning, I just listened to his vocal stuff and I said, fuck.
And
I don't know if he did ads. He did do ads. He did a lot of ads. I take that back. He did a lot of ads on camera.
Mm-hmm.
When he was in his, Don Draper phase.
Uh-huh.
Of the skinny suits and the skinny ties, and he would come out dressed like early Beatles sort of clothes with a short haircut. He did a lot of ads. He was a natural for it. You can look them up on YouTube.
I'm going to have to look at
those. I don't think he did anything after he grew his hair. Where did he live? Do you know where he lived?
He lived out here. I believe Santa Monica, because I know that his daughter Kelly, who's been on the show, was raised right around there. And she went to school with, like, Bob Newhart's kid and Richard Pryor's kids. It's very weird. They all knew each other. They're all good friends.
Now, speaking of Stan Freberg.
Yes.
Stan Freberg's son had a moment of fame in the 1990s.
Okay.
Where he appeared. He appeared in some 60 seconds. Maybe they were infotainment. Maybe they were a minute and a half. TV commercials selling, this is pre-internet, to pitch parents to buy Encyclopedia Britannica for their kids at a discount.
Okay.
And I think they may have been written or directed by his dad. Anyway, he had this fleeting moment. He's a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, Swedish-looking kid. And whatever he tried in comedy may not have worked. He is now a portrait photographer in Los Angeles.
Hmm.
Apparently a very good one. And he never followed in dad's footsteps. I would say, too, that in terms of voice work, Stan Freberg, that's an acting chop that I never got. Carlin may have been acting, but Carlin's thing is more about behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Stan Freberg could actually act. And I've, you know, writing that thing for 99% Invisible and for KCRW, The Organist, if I can plug them, produced by Andrew Leyland. Carlin's a behavioralist, and Freberg absolutely has acting chops in there. I've heard outtakes of him where he's putting himself through acting, voice acting paces. He's directing himself through stuff. He was really good.
That's amazing.
Really, really good.
Did you ever listen? Did you listen to his albums, mm-hmm. Freberg's album?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry. On the special, it's mentioned. I apologize. I always ask questions like that. But, of course, you specifically mentioned the history of the United States, if I'm not mistaken.
I didn't mention the history of the United States.
You didn't? Then why is my brain thinking that you did? Okay, well, then I did ask the right question.
Because you wished that I had mentioned the history of the United States. I became aware of Stan Freberg through his commercials. I didn't know he was... and through his cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know he was... I didn't know he had comedy albums and that he was a satirist,
mm-hmm.
and that his real position on, or at least a third of his position on everything, was as a satirist. And when I got my hands on that, and again, that would have been around, that was absolutely around the when I went through puberty.
Ah.
Most people go through puberty and they get very interested in sex. I went through puberty and I got very interested in Rusty Warren, George Carlin, Flip Wilson, and Stan Freberg. And not that I didn't think about sex,
sure.
But sex didn't command my attention as much as these men and women did, because I just thought, Jesus, there's a world out here beside these dumb pimply teenagers I'm going to school with that they have no idea. They just want to get stoned and fuck and you know, be sort of try and be hippies like their older brothers and sisters. But I had a bent that I was listening to Stan Freberg in the United States of America. I was at all of that happened too, and this is interesting Because in 1974 and 1973, when Watergate exploded,
mm-hmm.
all of these things were happening. And all of these comedians were happening. And they were commenting on all of this stuff. And that's when I became extremely skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
I became extremely skeptical of how the world was operating because I grew up in the States. I grew up in Buffalo,
mm-hmm.
and although I'm a Canadian, and listening to, and I, you know, I grew up in the Kennedy thing. Kennedy, I was six or seven when he was killed. Six or seven, I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Martin Luther King, I knew who he was. And my parents backed Dr. King, and they backed the Kennedys. And I lived in New York State, and why not, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Watergate happened, and you had George Carlin and Flip Wilson and the Smothers Brothers, and you know, commenting on this, Rusty Warren was now out of the spotlight. But I think Joan Rivers may have commented on all of this stuff too, and Phyllis Diller never did, but. Those guys, that 5-year window between 1970 and 1975, so much happened to millions of little Western kids like me in terms of what is funny and what is not, and how far can we push this thing called irony, and how far can we push this thing pointing out the hypocrisy of the of the world around us.
Sure.
And there were great. I don't know what they do now. I mean, people tell me that I should watch Dave Chappelle.
Mm-hmm.
And but in the end, I'm not. I guess I'm just. I don't know. I'm not that big a fan of watching stand-up and watching comedians. I'm too busy writing.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
How about you? Do you watch a lot of comedy? Are you too busy interviewing and writing?
Right. That does tend to take up most of my time, writing, editing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, acting, whatever. But yeah, I mean, even I tried last year to listen to a comedy album a day to like at least start listening to more albums. That failed 130 some albums in. I've tried to go watch more because there are a couple of comics who I can reliably get a laugh from, and I don't mind going out based on that. But I have trouble going out and just seeing, hey, who's out and who's funny? Because if they're not good, I'm gonna want to leave immediately and then be too uncomfortable and have to stick around. So I'm very picky about when I go see comedy.
Well, I learned a very important lesson when I was 22. Through a long and not so interesting series of circumstances, I became chums with the singer Anne Murray's husband.
Uh huh.
You remember Anne Murray?
Uh-huh.
You needed me from the 70s. Anne's from Toronto. Well, she's actually from Nova Scotia, from Pugwash, Nova Scotia, but she lived here. And I was in the recording business, and so I've met Anne many times. She's not a friend of mine, she's just barely an acquaintance. But I got to know her husband and Bill. And Bill had a lot of time on his hands because he raised the kids, and they're two kids. But it wasn't really necessary for Bill to have a full-time job. And he had had a full-time job. He had been a producer, television producer, for 25 years out in Halifax on a show called Don Messer's Jubilee, which is where he met his wife, Anne.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me one day at lunch, a rather boozy lunch, and that wasn't always our lunches, but this one I remember we'd had a lot of martinis. And he said to me, Clive, if you go into a situation and you don't like it, just leave. I said, really? He said, yeah, you're free. You don't have to hang around. That's all bullshit. Just get up and leave. If you're not enjoying yourself at a play or a movie or a concert or you're at a dinner party, you know, as soon as you can get out of there, get out. Just leave. Nobody cares.
Pretty good
advice. So when it comes to movies and comedy and live performances and stuff, I just get up and leave.
Yeah,
you know, I say I'll be back in a minute, or I have to go to the restroom now, and then I just leave. And I advise everybody. I tell all the youngsters. I say, you know what? You want to be the needle, not the haystack.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're just go, you know, they'll remember you.
Well, I'm happy you haven't had to take a restroom break during this podcast, so that means something.
No, I'm enjoying talking to you. I think it's really fun. I've been in a heavy period of writing right now, and I haven't been able to talk to really anybody.
So, yeah, I understand that. That can be a relief.
because it's really fun talking to somebody about comedy. I just hope I'm somewhat amusing or interesting.
Oh, absolutely. I want to make sure, though, that so since we picked FM and AM, I like to have my guests at the end say, give people a reason. Why make this the first? Let's say you've never heard Carlin before, maybe you don't even know much about him. What's a reason to listen to this album as a first example of who he is?
You don't need to listen to this album about... this is the reason you want to listen to this is because it's a really good introduction to George Carlin's ability to critically think. This record, in a way that you don't hear anymore, and you rarely hear anymore in comedy, and if you do hear it, a lot of it has to go back, a lot of the kudos have to go to him for doing this. He is talking about ideas. He's not talking about what happened to me at the airport. He's not talking about my cab ride into the city,
yeah,
or my fight with my wife. He's talking about, and he's reverse engineering the, he's thinking about all the things we don't think about. And he's reverse engineering what is FM radio and why do people say shit and why is shit a bad word and what are bad words and what are good words and how is our society really, how's it all put together on these such a flimsy basis? And by pulling this stuff apart, and this is what he does on FM and AM, he shows you that, you know, don't take any of this stuff for granted that you're being told. Much of it's nonsense. And he's doing an exorcism in a way, culturally. It's both an autopsy and an exorcism of the culture of 1972 that we were living in. I mean, remember that Nixon's the president. Your country was embroiled in a violent and senseless war, mm-hmm, that to this day no one's ever been able to justify, other than it was making the military-industrial complex very rich.
Yeah.
There's a lot of money there. And they were having a great time and making a ton. And... he just ripped apart everything, but he did it. He didn't do it in a, and he had such style. He had such style and such grace. If you want to hear how the society was, and if you want to hear why it's the way it is today in 2017, you want to listen to FM and AM by George Carlin, because he's going to show you, he's going to reverse engineer where it was we were at that point. And that was just... how many years? That was 8 years before everything really turned on its dime,
mm-hmm,
when the Ayatollah Khomeini came back.
Mm-hmm.
Ayatollah Khomeini? Khomeini? Khomeini. What is it?
Potato, potato.
When the Ayatollah left Paris and went back into the Middle East, that's when everything went totally crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And but in 72, there was George Carlin, and he, as I said, he was doing either an autopsy... or he was doing
an exorcism,
a biopsy,
or
an exorcism. You know, he's much older too. He was around 40 at that point, no?
I think so. Yeah, he was at least in his mid-30s, if not 40. Yeah, he was. I love that about him too. He's not necessarily a super young guy, but he definitely he knew how to talk to people. And as you said, it appealed to you too when you were a really young kid. I love that it had that kind of range of influence and interest.
He was very big. They used to play. Toronto's an unusual town, as you probably come to, or as you may sense, because of the amount of comedians who
came
from here,
yeah,
and the amount of creative people who... you live in Los Angeles, is that
I do,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Los Angeles is the third largest Canadian city. There's a million Canadians living in LA, and you probably know some of them.
Mm-hmm. I do. And every time they're on the podcast, I force them to talk about Canadian content.
Or maybe they come and they trim you, they work on your yard or clean your pool. I don't know what the Canadians are doing there. But it's at that point in 1970, there was a radio station here called Chum FM, and Chum FM had gone. I think the guy in San Francisco was a guy called Ralph Gleason, who introduced FM radio as we know it,
mm-hmm,
as we knew it in those days. It was freestyle, freeform. You'd play, you know, an entire side of the Grateful Dead's, you know, guitar solo for 30 minutes, And then you'd play Stairway to Heaven three times in a row, and you'd do whatever you wanted. And there was a state, there was a comparable station here called Chum FM, and Sundays on Chum FM was dedicated to comedy, Sunday nights. And they didn't give a flying fuck about the regulations.
Uh-huh.
They played George Carlin uncensored. They played Flip Wilson, George Carlin, everybody, Firesign Theater.
I love it.
All of that stuff on Friday nights. And so, and that was starting in around 1971. Now, they got in trouble for it.
Uh-huh.
But they did it.
I love it. That's
and
so good.
So hundreds of thousands of kids, maybe millions of kids, in Toronto and in Western New York heard this. They heard George Carlin, and George Carlin was telling you all the things. The reason you want to listen to FM and AM is George Carlin's going to tell you the things your parents refused to tell you. He's going to own up and tell you what a pile of bullshit it all is and how much hypocrisy is running. And these are the things your parents were too inculcated in the society, too deep in how it all operated.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the spiritual and mental freedom, and they did not have the vocal alacrity and intellectualism and rapier wit that this guy Carlin had. To his credit too, Flip Wilson had it. And to her credit, to go back to where we began, Rusty Warren also had this. Rusty Warren, she was a futurist and she was a prophet. By getting those, you know, broads to go up on stage half cut and wander around in front of their loudest chauvinist husbands with martini flutes on their boobs was light years ahead of its time.
It's perfect. I love that this is also, so this is great because this is episode 250, and I like that we've covered multiple subjects, and you're the first person to request that we talk about Rusty Warren on the show, which is weird to me. I normally have to introduce people to Rusty, so it's been fun talking to somebody who also knows Rusty's work, and I love that.
Well, if fair use lets you do it, you should end the show by playing Rusty's Knockers Up, ladies.
It's not a bad idea. You know, I used to put clips in every episode, and I haven't for the last half a year or so. But you know what? I feel like this is the time to do it. That's a perfect ending for this.
Do you have any friends who are composers?
I do. I do have some friends who are.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Here's what you do. I want you to take a Flip Wilson. Tell them, sample Flip Wilson as Geraldine.
Uh-huh.
Sample George Carlin as George Carlin, mm-hmm, from AM/FM, and then sample a clip of Rusty Warren,
mm-hmm,
and then put it against some kind of rock and fucking beat and make a track out of it.
Oh, my God.
And run it for the last minute of your show. Say, folks, we have a special. It's a combination of things going. We don't know what it is. It's the ultimate in counterculture comedy on Comedy on Vinyl. Why are you doing Comedy on Vinyl? Where did this idea come to you?
I wanted to do a podcast back in 2010, and I realized that just because I wanted to be able to expose people to my work, which it really hasn't done that, but that's okay. We got a lot of people who listen, and I realized what's the one thing, and I thought all podcasts had to have a theme. I was wrong, and I was like, well, what's the one thing I'm interested in that I would like to learn more about and talk about, and that was vinyl comedy albums. And I was smart enough within the first few episodes to bring on people who knew way more about it than I did and have since learned, you know, a ton about this kind of stuff. People still assume I'm an expert, which I don't consider myself to be, but unless it's like sketch, I'm something of an expert on. But yeah.
Well, you speak in you ask questions in a manner that seems, and this is good. You have created the impression that you are an expert in the manner in which you speak. It all sounds so legit.
Well, like, I will say I've at least studied comedy my whole life. I can at least say that I have been, like, because comedy is my thing and sketch comedy is my baby. I've been doing sketch comedy now. Most people wouldn't count it, but since I was 13, so that this year is 25 years that my sketch comedy group has been a group. You know, I was 13, yes, but it's been, we still have a sketch comedy group and we have a podcast about it. So yeah. So at the very least on some level, sure. Maybe I'm an expert. I'll take that.
There's a group. There's a couple of guys here who have a sketch comedy podcast.
Uh huh.
Where they have no idea what they're going to do until they go in. Now, these guys are all really funny. They're all professional actors and comic types.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it once a week. And I'll send you, after we're finished, I'll send you a link to see what they do.
Please do.
And it's just interesting. They just go in and then they cut it all together. They've been doing it for, I think, 6 or 7 years.
That's amazing.
And I don't know how popular it is, but they appear places and people go and see it.
Sure.
I could not do it myself. Now, do you know why Canadians, why there are so many funny Canadians in New York and in L.A.?
I'm sure there'd be a reason that I don't know anything about.
Canadians are not very nice to each other. They have a reputation. They have a reputation. Oh, the Canadians are so polite and so willing to go along with it. They're always saying sorry and thank you and please and sorry and thank you and please. You know, they say sorry to ATMs. I've actually seen it. It's thank you. I've seen a guy take fucking money out of the thing and say thank you. I said, dude, it's a fucking machine. It's a robot, I'm thinking. However, they go because Canadians aren't that nice to one another, and that's the elephant in the china shop that nobody up here wants to say. They all think that because everybody outside the country buys the illusion, the carefully crafted and well rehearsed illusion of politeness, but it isn't. It's not true. They're really shitty to each other. You come into Canada as a Canadian, and you would think that you had been, you know, part of the Manson family for the past 15 years. When I travel to the United States and I go through U.S. Customs here at Pearson International Airport, it's like the Jehovah's Witnesses showed up. Hello, Mr. Desmond. What are you coming to the United States for today? Well, I have a session in Los Angeles. Will you be doing anything at the session today, Mr. Desmond? No, my appearance there is purely ceremonial. You know, clients always feel they need somebody representing their better interests when these things go on in L.A. The guys say, I completely understand that. Stamp and go through. You come back here, and the guy says, where have you been? I've been in Tulum. What were you doing in Tulum? It's a drug cartel down. Drug cartels work down there, don't they? Yes, they do, but I've been doing yoga. Okay, where? At Yoga Tulum. At Maya Tulum. Oh, and what brand yoga mat do you have? I said, what brand yoga mat do I have? What brand yoga? I don't know what brand yoga. I can vaguely remember I just bought a new one. Why are you asking me this? He said, I just want to know if you, because yoga people are really into their mats. I said, it's a manduka. Now I remember. Have you heard of a manduka before? This is how Canadians treat each other. They are petty, petty people. And if I were you, I would date an American or an Italian or anybody but a Canadian. But the Canadians can be relied on to be polite. So I hope I have been.
Absolutely have. Can you, this is coming out tonight, later tonight. So what would you like to promote?
You. I would like to promote that people listen to Jason's show, Comedy on Vinyl, that you listen to it tonight. And yes, I won't stop right here. I'll say, ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Comedy on Vinyl with your host, Jason Klum.
That's correct. That's correct. And I will say what I usually say, which is A, thank you for being here. B, thank you guys all for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.
Freedom was for men alone. Oh, no, you take Tom Jefferson, Ben Franklin, John Hancock. There's a hell of a guy for you right there. All these men had wives. They probably had a few broads on the side, too. These women wanted freedom just as much as their men did. But, gals, I wonder, do we? I think it's time that we women thought about it a bit. Hell, I think it's time we did something about it. So come on, fellow females of the 20th century. Be glad that you're an American. Proclaim your freedom. Stand at attention. Pledge allegiance. And bounce your boobies. Get into the swing. Bounce your boobies. The swing is everything. Makes no difference if they're big or small. As long as you give them your all. Something to give. But it sure looks like it sometimes. Just look around you. Men stick out all over the place. Big fat cigars. Big fat stomachs. And just where they should stick out, where is it? Yes, girls, we know what we've got and we know what they're worth. So come on, gals. Let's get into the swing of things. Give your boobies some freedom. All together now.